Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast on our Week in IndyCar series, presented by Cooper Tires, supported by PNC Bank. This is the final episode of the season. When we come back next week, it'll be our first, not only of the postseason, but we'll get to talk about our new champion. Who's that going to be? Scott Dixon, Alexander Rossi, or one of the two Team Penske drivers tied for third, the only ones mathematically available, Will Power and Joseph Newgarden. We've had the Rookie of the Year tied up here with Robert Wickens, which is pretty darn awesome. Also got some news last week about the full extent of Robert's injuries, which we speak about here momentarily with our friend and our guest, Lee Diffie from NBCSN, who will be calling the championship showdown on NBCSN. Lee was with us just a few weeks ago to speak about the injuries that Robert suffered and the Pocono race as a whole. And knowing that, your response to Lee and all the really warm notes that were sent in, either on social media, by text, even some emails, Lee definitely appears to be a favorite guest, and he's a long, long-time friend of mine and one of my favorite guests. So whenever we have a chance to try and look at things, analyze, or get some reasonable perspectives, I know that our Australian friend, now a naturalized American citizen, he's the right guy to get on the other end of the phone. So heading into Sonoma this weekend, it's going to be a bit busy. We've got Thursday with tests with approximately half of the teams, the Andretti Autosport, obviously the key player there being Alexander Rossi, Chip Ganassi Racing, Dixie being the key player there. And after that, I believe we have the Max Chilton and Charlie Kimble types from Carlin Racing, and I guarantee you I'm forgetting one other one. But we had about half the teams, or I shouldn't say half. We had three teams testing last week at Sonoma on Thursday, and Dale Coyne, that's the other team I'm forgetting. So we'll have Andretti, Ganassi, Coyne, and Carlin testing this Thursday, all Honda-powered teams, barring Carlin on the Chevy front. And then we get into the race weekend proper on Friday with two sessions, Saturday with two sessions. Qualifying will obviously be a big part of how this race might play out. We've seen that in years past. It isn't always the rule, to be really honest. It's not always a guarantee that the first two rows are effectively going to stay the first two rows at the checkered flag, but we do know that it is a track where if you need a big result, having to drive through the field is, that's not a lot of fun. I mentioned another thing, that having been up there for the test on Thursday, doing a little bit of visor cam work with Pato O'Ward, who'll be making his debut alongside Colton Herta in the Harding Racing team. Boy, with 1,000 pounds less of downforce or so to play with compared to last year, they're working. They're really working. And so I think it's in that dynamic where this year's race, this year's double point season finale, might be a little bit more exciting than any of the finales we've seen in recent years where higher downforce was at play. So a lot of sliding, a lot of oversteer, a lot of understeer, a lot of catching the car, a lot of little wiggles. And so if we think about the cars really just being overstuck, overly planted from 2015 to 2017, thanks to those manufacturer aero kits, stepping away from that, seeing how much work Graham Rahal, all three Penske drivers, Takuma Sato, and Pato had to do last week there, I'm really hoping that carries over into the race weekend, because that could bring a lot of fun and a significant lack of predictable action.
PNC is proud to sponsor Scott Dixon, driver of the number 9 car for Chip Ganassi Racing. Everyone tunes in on race day, but so much of the race is determined off camera during the work put in throughout the week, month, and year. From the gym to the practice track, Scott Dixon and the team take small steps every day to get closer to victory lane. Copyright 2018, the PNC Financial Services Group Incorporated. All rights reserved. PNC Bank, National Association, member FDIC.
All right, before we get to Lee, two little notes of interest here. We're going to have our final Marshall Pruitt Podcast Week in IndyCar live event of 2018 at Sonoma. We're going to do that on Sunday. The good folks at Sonoma Raceway asked me to put on a little, kind of call it farewell, since this is our last visit to Sonoma, at least until IndyCar hopefully adds it back to the schedule. So, bidding farewell to the season. Well, we're also bidding farewell to Sonoma Raceway. We're also bidding farewell to Verizon. But for this podcast, we're going to do this Sunday. If you can attend, we would love for you to come out and have some fun. It'll be Sunday from 1 to 1:30. The race kicks off at, I think 3 o'clock or so. A little bit late in the day, trying to follow right after the NASCAR event on NBCSN. It's actually a 3:40 start. So come out about 2.5 hours before the start from 1 to 1:30. It's going to be in the paddock. It's going to be behind the main grandstand. There will be a dedicated stage. In there, we will have local product and good pal J.R. Hildebrand. He's not racing in the event, unfortunately, but he's always good for comedy and comments and intelligence. We're going to have IndyCar competition president Jay Fry. We're going to have some guy named James Hinchcliffe who's going to be there. He's actually showing up just a little bit late. He had a pre-existing commitment, so he said, I can pop in around 1:20. So we'll get him for about the second half of the show. And we will have young, new Indy Lights champion Pato O'Ward there as well. So I don't know if when Hint shows up, we're going to make him sit. Well, maybe we'll make him sit on Jay's lap. I was going to say Pato's, but that'd be a little bit strange. But yeah, we're going to have those four, JR, Jay, and James, plus Pato. And I'm also hoping that my super, super friend, and I guess call him a client, but don't think of him like that. Think of him like family. That being Paul Fanner, owner of Racer Magazine, Fanner Communications, and all of those good things. He's going to be up on the weekend having some very important conversations with folks. And if we can get a hold of him for a little while on Sunday, hopefully we can drag him up on the stage, because it's one thing to listen to drivers, series officials, or me yapping my good old mouth, but also cool to have someone like Paul who's been around IndyCar for longer than I've been alive and who has seen the trends, both TV and media and you name it. Maybe he can bring an interesting aspect to one of our live shows that we haven't had so far. And the final note on the event is it'll be our standard format where it will be largely listener slash fan Q&A driven. So we'll have all of them up on the stage, and I will plan on being in the crowd and try not to bump into too many with my wide behind and getting your thoughts and questions to them. So trying to say farewell to the track with style and love all that Steve Page and Diana Brennan and all those just super good folks there. There is a definite element of sorrow that we will no longer have Sonoma to go back to, at least for me. I know it's my home track. Duh, Pruitt, of course you're sad. We are going to Laguna next year. That's my other home track. But anyways, I grew up at Sears Point, by and large. Worked there forever for a variety of teams, sports car teams, open wheel teams, you name it. So when I go there, it feels like I'm going back to being 5 years old on up. So a little bit of sorrow there. On another quick note of sorrow, woke up this morning, September 11th, to the incredibly sad news that Dr. Don Panos had died. A relatively quick and unfortunate, sad end to a battle with pancreatic cancer. And I think while Don is most heavily known for all the amazing things he did in sports car racing, founding the American Le Mans Series, buying Sebring and Mosport and Road Atlanta and saving them and all the crazy cool sports cars that he built, well, he also has 2 Indy 500 wins to his credit when he took over the G-Force constructor and pumped a lot of money into that, did a lot of aero development and otherwise that allowed Team Penske to win the Indy 500 in 2003, Ray Hall Letterman racing in 2004, so a couple of Indy 500 victories to Don's credit. Then also he took over the Star race car constructor as well and produced the Star Mazda chassis, which ran forever in the 2000s, just frankly up until, a year ago, I think. So that was a really big thing that Don helped with on the open wheel front. And then, as you might have heard, our pals Will Power, Sebastian Bourdais, Simon Pagenaud, so many others say, that 2007 Panos DP01 Champ Car chassis was just visual perfection. They all pretty much say it's their favorite Indy car they've ever driven. One of the prettiest creations I've ever seen in open wheel racing. It bore Don's name, Panos. It even had his initials, DP01. And so, while we really think of Don and miss him with his sudden loss, unfortunately, and think about so many sports car things, just there's a big impact he had, believe it or not. It was a little bit sporadic, but still a very big impact on our world of open wheel racing. So, gonna miss you, Don. You were just an incredible, incredible person. Final item here. This is the fun part, hopefully, to balance a little bit of the sadness. Every week, courtesy of our dear friends at TorontoMotorsports.com, we pick my favorite question from the previous episode and ask that kind person to send me their info via DM and get you a new Week in IndyCar t-shirt. That would go to the awesome couple of Jamie and Jiffy Betha. And I still think I'm murdering your last name. I'm not sure if you go with Betha or Bethe. But I loved your question of, has there ever been any talk about doing a throwback race in IndyCar? I think it would be a great idea and would be very cool to do this coming off the back of NASCAR's throwback weekend. And Jay Fry did respond they have thought about it, and it's not out of the question. So while this question here might not have spawned, you know, long discourse afterwards, I just thought it was great, and I love Jay's response to it as well. So shoot me a DM, let me know what size t-shirt you would like and the address to send it to. Our friends at TorontoMotorsports.com will get you all sorted. And yeah, if you listened to our recent episode, not last week, but the week before with Zach Veach, there was my favorite question where someone asked about if we could choose a superpower, what would we go with and who would our sidekick be? And I chose flying, and Zach Veach suggested that I pick Robin Miller as my sidekick, and I think I said that would be the most depressing thing ever, and said that might actually be the saddest thing. But even sadder, if I really had to pick one, I'd probably go with our cat Rocky and fly through the air like Superman with carrying Rocky in a little pink basket, because it would just be really confusing and it'd make people laugh at me even more than they already do. Zach, then, being the nut that he is, and also a really good friend of the podcast, said, if someone draws that and makes a sticker out of that, I will put that on my helmet at Sonoma. I'm just saying, folks, I can't wait to get to Sonoma, because someone took him up on the offer. Having seen what was drawn, it is everything I feared it would be, which is, again, more reasons to point and laugh at me when I walk by. But, yeah, all right, Veach, you opened your big mouth, buddy, and someone gotcha. So, there's some fun coming, dear friends. And with that, it's like you were just here a couple weeks ago, Lee Diffie. How are you, my brother?
I'm good. It's been a crazy summer, but I think it's going to be nicely capped off by championship weekend this weekend, which is, I can't believe how quickly it's come around, but I'm super excited for it. So, yeah, really pumped.
We're recording this early on a Tuesday afternoon, Lee, and I will admit to waking up Monday morning, even though I was fully worn out from last weekend's IMSA race, just feeling a little bit sad that this 2018 IndyCar season is over. It's you know, we're days away from it being over. I normally don't have this kind of feeling going into Sonoma. It's usually, whoa, finally, thanks. This year has been so amazing, though. So unpredictable, so many storylines. Not all of them positive, some sad, but it's just been an incredible year. From a storytelling standpoint, I'm sure you, like me, are wishing we could add a few more chapters, but alas, we cannot.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when we come to this stage of any championship, you always reflect. But particularly this year, with the change in the aero kit for the car, and everyone was, you know, even last year when the first renderings came out, everyone was so excited just aesthetically how great the car looked, the new body kits. And then, you know, before we know it, around rolls St. Petersburg, and Robert Wickens on the pole position, and then the controversy at the end of that race, and then Sebastian Bourdais, right time, right place, and he wins, and everybody's gotten, you know, nothing but good things to say about the cars and the race and the series, and that was only the first round. And then here we are at coming up to round and race 17, and it's given us so much to talk about all year. And so I think that's probably why you're feeling a little bit, not sad, but a little bit hollow, you know, because it's we want it to continue. I wish we had a 20 race season. Yeah. Maybe that'll come down the road. But you know, I can almost certainly say once we get to Sunday afternoon on the West Coast, you know, the 17 races this year have just been so enjoyable.
I know that IndyCar competition president Jay Fry does have a goal of getting to 20 races at some point, Lee. So that number you mentioned, not saying it's happening 2020 or whatever, you know, I'm not putting a timeline on it, but I do know that Jay would love to get there. And at least so far, Jay has shown us that when he has a desire to do something, it usually happens. So, well, we've got a bunch of good things to get into. As usual, Lee, we've been going with the listener-driven Q&A. We will start off with a couple topics of our own. That being, we had the first full confirmation last week of Robert Wickens' injuries. And I know, based on the reaction, Lee, from many people, I would say most people on social media or article comments and whatnot, they were taken aback by how heavily injured Robert happened to be. I know that within the sport, it might not have been a surprise to most. As we discussed in the days after Robert's crash, one of the things we are tasked with, not just media, but crew members, you name it, is keeping the confidences of others. So I know that while many of us on the quote inside were not shocked to, or frankly, knew the condition Robert was in and what he dealt with, still a hard thing to swallow for many people. What were your thoughts on just the general reaction from folks on learning that, wow, Robert truly went through the wars inside that car during the crash?
Well, I think when you see it, when you see it in black and white, when you see it in bullet point list form, it definitely is more confronting. And I have to say, I took some time away from, you know, because we relived that multiple times on the broadcast looking at it, I actually took some time away from it. And then I watched it back recently, and then when you're armed with the information, the factual information of the extent of his injuries, and then you watch the clip back, it actually isn't surprising. You know, it was just so violent, I think, you know, on two fronts, the crash was confronting, and the list of injuries is confronting. But when you watch it back, it really isn't a surprise. The speed, the violence, just the turn in direction, the whipping nature of it all, and then you have the impact nature of it all. So, you know, as are all of us, we're continually thinking about Robert and a speedy recovery. You know, and I don't, you know, I'm not a doctor. I don't know. Of course, it's going to take a long time for him to be, you know, feeling a lot better because of the extent of those injuries. But boy, oh boy, he's got people all over the world. The messages on social media have been just beautiful. People's sincerity and warmth towards him. I mean, you know, as a young kid coming up through the junior formulae, you know, back in the Champ Car Atlantic days, etc. You know, it's not like he was a newcomer to the paddock, but given the period of time that he spent overseas, it really was like a newcomer to the paddock, and he was met with such warmth from people within the paddock, within the Verizon IndyCar Series, and the fans alike. Like, he really endeared himself to people straight away, purely based on his honest, straightforward personality and then what he did on the track as well. So, you know, he has got absolutely everybody behind him. I have to say, it felt very weird in Portland, speaking, like seeing the six car and speaking about Carlos Munoz in that six car. And when you see it, you know, what happens when you, as you know, when you broadcast, things come into your mind straight away purely based on habit. And it was quite difficult not to mention Robert's name, yeah, in the same way, like in the split second, as soon as you see that Lucas Honda, you know, that Schmidt-Peterson car. So, yeah, that was quite interesting. But I'm pleased that the family and the team were in a position to actually let the greater public know the true extent of his injuries.
And we're not looking to break any news here that is not mentioned first by the family, and we're not claiming to know anything that is different than what has been published. I will say, and again, please, dear listeners, do not take this as anything major being said, but just heard some things last weekend that made me smile, that were would fall into the category of encouraging. And I know I'm overstating, but just in a very heavy situation like this, mate, where you read the full list, you have that confirmed, and you know everyone's like, oh man, boy, this is going to be a long road. Any little thing that makes you smile, whether it turns out to be true or not, you know, it was just one of those things where I was like, okay, a little ray of sunlight here, an additional ray of sunlight. At least for me, did not hurt at all. Let's move to the showdown coming up this weekend, Lee, and we're about to dive into listener questions. I wanted to add, just ahead of that, though, a little bit of context from last Thursday's test at Sonoma Raceway that I happened to attend, that being one with the Team Penske drivers, that being the Ray Hall Edelman Lanigan team coming off of their win at Portland, and also Harding Racing with Pato O'Ward. So if you might have seen the visor cam or the little video I did with Pato after his first laps. Two really interesting things to come out of this, Lee, and I have not mentioned either beforehand, in print or otherwise. And there is a little story here that might be newsy, but we'll see. First of all, Pato, at the genuine end of the day, not the colloquialism at the end of the day, but at the true end of the day, according to unofficial lap times, was about 0.4 seconds off of Joseph Newgarden, who was fastest. If you take into account that Pato had never seen Sonoma Raceway before he turned his first laps there in an IndyCar, that's phenomenal. If you take into account the fact that he was driving for Harding Racing and was only 0.4 off of Pato, off of Newgarden, that's amazing. Had also heard that he was about 0.4 up on Graham Rahal, which would be even more amazing. Now, there's, you know, a few factors to consider. Who is on what tires at what time late in the day? You know, there could have been a couple of factors that might have put Graham ahead, etc. But the fact that we're talking about a rookie doing his first ever IndyCar test on a track that we both know can bite you badly if you try and get ahead of yourself, I was thoroughly impressed by how this kid seemed to be completely unfazed by it all.
I think that's tremendous. Great news for him, and great news, you know, for this weekend and also the future as well. And as we're in, you know, anybody who's a fan or associated with open wheel racing and is familiar with the Mazda road to Indy, and with Mazda, you know, opting to spend their resources elsewhere and away from the junior formulae, I just think it's a lovely parting gesture almost for Mazda just to say thank you when he's just won the Indy Lights Championship and then goes on and makes that tangible step to IndyCar, and when he jumps in one is more than competent. That's what the ladder system's all about, and you know, we're seeing, and I don't want to call them kids, but we're seeing youngsters now like Zach Veach really belong in IndyCar racing. Spencer Pigot, a podium, and then, you know, rounding up, passing Scott Dixon into the fast chicane at Portland. You know, we're seeing that ladder system, you know, really be validated. And I think, you know, because people, if you see kids that top the ladder system, no matter what the various categories are, whether it's USF 2000, you know, Pro Mazda, Indy Lights, if they're reaching those goals of succeeding at those levels, but then not going on with it, you know, sometimes that might lead people to question or the validity of those series. But, you know, we're seeing time and again, you know, the next one after the next one, and Pato Award is the latest one, to validate. And you know, it's not easy when you only see seven or eight Indy Lights out on the track, and, you know, it's not, at times it's not the greatest spectacle. But then, you know, and all you got to do is look at the couple of races in Portland most recently, when he clinched the title in the first of the two races. He and Colton Herta had a tremendous hit out. I just think it's really good when the junior series, the ladder series, are validated by the driver's performance once they get to the big league. I think that's terrific.
Well, amen to that. We had one other fun little thing, and it's fun with rabbit ears here, my friend. So I rang the Andretti team early last week, once I saw that Pato was going to be doing his first test, said, hey, you know, we always try and give love to the Indy Lights champ and, you know, want to make a big deal out of their first test. Would like to maybe do a visor cam or something. Curious who I need to speak with. Was to, oh, not us. 100% not us. Definitely not us. You need to talk to the Harding team. Nothing to do with it. Said, oh, okay. But keep in mind, the request was all based about me going up to Sonoma to do this. So I get to Sonoma, and who are the first people that I see? Or what's the first thing that I see driving into the paddock? An Andretti Autosport transporter. parked right next to the Harding transporters. And once I get out, who do I see? Andretti Autosport's chief operating officer, our pal Rob Edwards. Their technical director, Eric Bretzman, another old pal. Old roommate of mine, you know, road roommate back in the day in the IRL with the team we worked for, Jeremy Millis, Alexander Rossi's race engineer, and it's Mark Pato's Indy Lights engineer, and it's, you know, this Andretti chief mechanic, and that guy, you know, I'm like, okay, not involved, not us, ain't us, talk to the Harding people, got it. By the way, I did ring Brian Barnhart and said, hey, what do you think? He's like, yeah, great, let's do it. So, anyways, now, everything I just mentioned, Lee, was not a surprise. I did expect him to be there. I did find it a little bit funny, you know, the whole, granted, and I'm not trying to toot horns here, but I did break the news about the Andretti Junior team, Andretti Harding alignment. And so seeing all this play out in front of me wasn't a surprise. It was just a little bit funny based on the prior phone call, saying, ah, not us, definitely not us. So that's not the interesting part. So knowing that we have Andretti's Indy Lights champion in the Harding car, we have some of the most badass engineers on the planet there in support, it's pretty clear that there was a very heavy Andretti involvement in this test. Now, this was a private test, a rookie test as well. So I'm sitting there, and as you do, Lee, on a test day, there'll be some delays. The team had some mechanical problems, had to change out a fuel pump, and blah, blah, blah. There's more sitting around in the morning at most tests than you would want. And so it's just truly standing out in front of the garage, BSing with Jeremy or Eric or Rob about, you know, honestly, it's rarely about racing. It's usually about some other thing. Then wander down to pit lane. Same thing, you know, checking the stopwatch. Hey, Jeremy, who'd you get as fastest on that lap? Or whatever, whatever. Just normal situations. About 11:30, because I'm a rather oblivious person, Lee, about 11:30, I look around. I'm like, where'd everybody go? You know, the Harding team is still running the car, and, you know, Pato is out doing his thing, but all my friends that I was chatting with kind of disappeared. And now, I will admit that I did get a text or two from some other folks in the paddock who weren't there, asking, hey, have you seen this guy or that guy? And I had to politely say, sorry, you're my source. I'm not your source, which wasn't necessarily appreciated. Like, hey, wait a minute, you're trying to pump the reporter for information? I said, sorry, guys, that's I'm not playing that game. But Barnhart came over, I don't know, a few minutes after I noticed and said, hey, just a little FYI, IndyCar rang our friends, or the senior members from the Andretti team, and told them, you got two choices. You either leave now, or we're going to count this as an Andretti private test day, which means the one that you have reserved for next week, which is 2 days from now, Lee, on Thursday with your cars, will be gone. So we're not comfortable with the amount of Andretti involvement and possibly, not saying they did any of this, not alleging anything, just stating the at least appearance of using the Harding test day with a rookie kid who's the Andretti Indy Lights champion to maybe use dampers or other things from the Andretti team to learn, then spend a week crunching that info and really getting up to speed so that when they tested their own cars, one of those vying for a championship with Alexander Rossi, they'd be even further ahead. It sounds like calls were made to the series and said, hey, we think this might not be as fair as it possibly could. So that ultimatum was provided, and that's why I no longer had my pals to speak with. So that was a little bit of drama, for sure.
We wouldn't love it so much if there wasn't a little bit of gamesmanship, right?
And then I found out after the fact of who was singing the song, who dropped the old dime, and I'm not going to mention who that was either, but when I, you know, how's this? There were three teams testing at the event, or at the track. You know, if we're having to guess, you know, we wouldn't have to look far to imagine, you know, it's not as if every team was there, and we had to guess which one of them might have dropped the dime. All I can say is, there was some corrective actions taken, and Pato went on and spent the rest of the day on his own, and we will look forward to seeing the other teams testing this Thursday. All right! That little fun story aside, my friend, let's jump in to Q&A. We've got you for about another 40-ish minutes or so, 45 minutes, and then we are going to bid farewell. All right, let's see. Ben Cohen says, MP and Lee, what are your favorite season finale memories for IndyCar? He says, it feels like this weekend could rank up there in terms of excitement regarding the season title fight. What stands out, mate? What's a good season closer for IndyCar from your memory?
Oh, that's really good, isn't it? I mean, for me being an Aussie, you know, quite often the IndyCar season used to finish in Australia. And there was always a lot of excitement about that. I think those dramatic years where Dario Franchitti was involved, Ryan Hunter-Reay was involved, when Will Power was trying to get that elusive championship. I think, you know, just the dramatic way in which it ended and the points changed incredibly. I think it's Sonoma, the one that we will be referring to a lot this year, where you know, Scott Dixon, I don't think too many people were talking about Scott that year when Montoya had led for so long.
They tied,
and Scott won on a countback with better, higher positions, more wins, more podiums.
Want to know how important you are? I just sent Mark Miles to voicemail. So, just a little confirmation how much we love us and Lee Diffie.
Look, I tell you in a... Yeah, I've given you some specifics there, but I tell you what I love the most about the Verizon IndyCar Series is the amount of years that it has. And I'm getting off the track here. I know it's a separate discussion about double points at the season ender, but the way that I love the championship comes down to the final race, and it has been so many years in succession, where it has come down, and, you know, at worst, it'd be between two drivers. At best, there might be five. And I just love the way that's to me, that's a real testament to the championship. and to the quality of the drivers and how it comes down to that. And, you know, being very selfish as a broadcaster, and for us it's we're covering a sport, but it's also entertainment for people at home. It's a business for those people involved, and it's a business for us. But to have a crescendo like that at the end of the season, that's what gets me excited. It's the most difficult to commentate or describe on something that doesn't mean anything, meaning a race that doesn't crown a champion, or, you know, kind of the event has already been decided. Whereas when, you know, you said you woke up yesterday morning, and I was exactly the same, like, just super excited for this weekend because it's all on the line, and we could not ask for any more. So I hope that answers the question.
I'll throw 2014 Fontana, DJ Willie P winning his title, Ben, as being one of my most recent favorites, and that's due to having been there and watching him come close and throw it away, or, you know, the variety of mistakes that Will made to become a non-champion when it seemed like he would have had two or three, especially in the years fighting with Dario, where we know that he had the speed and potential but couldn't execute. And just remember how 2014 was such a delightful, delightful outcome, where he finally got the job done. And I think we also, Lee, that was the event where the legend of Liz Power and the munched water bottle started, for sure. So I'll say that one, Ben. For me, that was definitely a lot of fun. Let's see. Let's go to Mike Dickinson. One right up your alley, Lee. Said, with the rise of IndyCar and its now more international appeal, do you think an Australian or New Zealand event, two or three race swing, would be successful in January or February to open the season? That being the Down Under summertime, for those who aren't aware.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see why not. You know, we the series traditionally kicks off in March. So I don't see why not. I mean, as far as attracting the Aussie crowds, you know, you're in the summertime, you're up against cricket, and you're up against the beach. So there are two other big you know, attracting factors for people to spend their time. But why not? I mean, the viewership down under is still very strong, just because, you know, Aussies have always had a love, you know, of IndyCar, especially now with Will Power being the only Australian to ever win the Indianapolis 500, and people with such fond memories of Surfers Paradise for all those years. And so I don't see why not. And there are, you know, I think there's going to have to be governmental involvement, meaning whichever state it's in. So if it is back in Surfers Paradise, Queensland government's got, you know, have to be involved to help IndyCar out financially to make it happen. There's a brand new track in South Australia outside of Adelaide called The Bend. I have not been there myself, but I have a lot of friends who have been there who just said say it's world class. To me, Phillip Island would be an interesting option. I think I don't see why not. I kind of like the idea that if you're going to go all that way to make a two-race swing, why not? I don't think if it was early in that time of the year, like in January, I don't think you'd be able to pull it off because of the closeness in dates to the big supercar race on the abbreviated old Grand Prix track in Adelaide called the Clipsal 500. I don't think that would go. I don't think that would go down. But I think you could choose some other venues, and why not? And I think IndyCar is, you know, you mentioned earlier about Jay Fry, you know, potentially looking at a 20 race schedule, and I think, you know, the man you just turned down on your voicemail, you got a voicemail from Mark Miles. I think Mark's open to it. Then nobody's digging their heels in and saying we're perfect. These 17 races, this is where it's going to stay. I mean, look, for 2019, we're going to Circuit of the Americas in Austin, Texas. So I think IndyCar is moving in such a nice way where they're reincorporating some tracks that have great IndyCar heritage, like Portland 2 weeks ago. I just loved that event. I thought that was a phenomenal success all round. The race, the crowd, the weather, the atmosphere, the way that people welcome the series back. But then at the same time, IndyCar's not being naive and close-minded about, well, we can't go anywhere new either, or maybe, you know, go farther afield. So, yeah, I don't see why not, Mike. Good question.
Go to our pal Kevin Frederico. He says, hey, Marshall and Lee, with IndyCar securing a new TV package and date stability, any word on who could be replacing Verizon's as the title sponsor at the end of the season? Funnily enough, that's what I was calling to get an update from Mark Miles about, Kev. So, unfortunately, I can't answer that now, but hopefully we'll have something to write about here shortly after we are done. And he also mentioned how he appreciates that NBC is working with the series to try and help locate new advertising partners and whatnot, and how it shows that NBC cares about their partners and producers. So, well spotted there, Kevin. Buddy Campbell says, with the talk of Indy Lights using the same tub as IndyCar in the future, could Indy Lights be used as an entry point for new manufacturers in the series? Said NASCAR is a similar process through the Xfinity and Truck Series. Could we use Indy Lights as a training ground for teams and drivers? Or since we use lights as a training ground for teams and drivers, why not train manufacturers as well? I'd say, Buddy, very different worlds here. If you think about Toyota coming in, for example, to NASCAR, NASCAR world is so foreign to any other form of racing, not just from the type of vehicles, but the type of technology, circuits and such. Using one of the lower tiers for a manufacturer to get up to speed makes a lot of sense. If we're talking IndyCar, we're probably looking at a situation where, you know, billion-dollar auto manufacturers aren't exactly needing to learn how to do what they want to do by going to Indy Lights. There's just that, to me, it's, I get the concept, just a little bit of too different of a fit and application. Plus, I'm not sure I want to turn Indy Lights into a manufacturer's battleground, Lee. I'm rarely an advocate for spec series and spec anything, but in this instance, I think a rather simplified Indy Lights series where driving and educating the driver is the number one priority. I like the simplicity there. So, but I'm also confident, Buddy, that if a new manufacturer wanted to get involved in IndyCar, IndyCar, while it is an incredibly tough challenge, it is not, you know, we're talking about engines and electronic control units, not having to build cars from scratch like you do in Cup. Let's go to Thomas Gross. Love this one. He says, since Colton Herta and Pato Ward are racing for Harding this weekend, can you please go ahead and announce the partnership? This Lee goes back to something we mentioned in the beginning about Robert Wickens. Sometimes we are asked, sometimes we know when to keep our mouths shut based on the situation, and other times we're asked to sit on something and not necessarily say zero, but not put too fine of a point on what's coming. Maybe it's the team, maybe it's a sponsor, maybe it's a father saying, hey, we want to really make a big deal out of this. You know, could you, I know you know about it, could you please not get ahead of us? So we can say that we look forward to these two Andretti Indy Lights teammates who finished 1-2 in the Lights Championship, racing this weekend in Sonoma, Lee, making their IndyCar debut together. If folks were to tune in around the middle of next week for some potential announcements and or interesting news hitting the wires, that would be a smart thing to do. But other than that, we will go ahead and leave everything up to whomever might have something to say. How's that sound for trying not to evade things too heavily, but not saying too much because we've been asked not to?
Yep, I'm with you.
Let's see. Horatio Frey, let's do an easy question. Who is going to win the championship and why? So, since you already have the script and know who's going to win, can you go ahead and reveal that here on the Week in IndyCar?
Well, look, I think you know, if you believe in a higher power, and just the way that things roll, I mean, the fact that Scott Dixon was able to drive out of that dust bowl that first lap, third corner crash in Portland with no significant damage on his car. And then the way that the race unfolded for Alexander Rossi and the Andretti team, to then, you know, looking like Scott at one point in the Portland race, Scott was 40 points behind to then leave with a 29 point advantage. One would have to say Scott Dixon. And then to back that up, you know, not with just a feeling, but statistically or mathematically, even if Alexander wins the race, which, given his form over the last half a dozen races, and just given the amazing year that he's had, the wonderful year that Alexander Rossi's had, even if Alexander is to win the race in his home state, so long as Scott Dixon finishes ninth, at least ninth, Dixon still wins the title. So you would have to say across the course of, you know, the best part of the last 20 years of Scott Dixon's career, the amount of times he's finished worse than 10th, it doesn't happen a lot.
No, well, so, I was just going to mention, I honestly have never asked Dixie if he is a man of faith. But I can tell you, Lee, if he does not show up at Sonoma with about 14 crosses hanging from around his neck and prayer beads and all kinds of stuff, that boy failed to get the message that the Lord loves him like nobody else. That's the only way we can explain the opening lap at Portland, so I hope Dixie shows up just crossed out.
Look, I just think with it all on the line, even just with what I had just said, the mathematics are there just to say that it is a little bit of an uphill task. But the way that this series has twisted and turned this year, and just when we thought things were predictable, who knows? It gives us a reason all to watch and to be excited. And I know I can speak on behalf of our entire team, but in particular, Paul Tracy and Townsend Bell, they're jacked. Like, they are super jacked about this weekend. And then, you know, if you think about it, and this is, you know, it's one of your two home tracks, Marshall, just up the road from San Francisco, you think about that cresting turn two at the top of the hill, go through one, flat out, cars G out and bottom out, and you climb the hill there. How many times in the last race of the championship finale have we seen something happen right there? And that turn two area could be a championship ender for somebody.
Or gearbox problems is another thing that happens often. Coming down the hill from the S's into the little motorcycle section with the chicane, how often do we see someone blow that braking zone, fly through the dirt and dust, and come close to tagging someone who had already gone through the corner from behind, or turn 11, it is...
I know.
If the finale was at Portland, mate, we would not be talking about this, because barring the final chicane going into the final corner, there are very few places to really, truly mess up. Obviously, I get turn one, the festival corner at the start, but if you get through that, for the most part, we wouldn't be sweating the rest of the event. Sonoma's one of those places where, whether it's the potential of crashes up and down a hill, or things breaking, or whatever... There will be many Liz Power bottles being chewed up by a lot of people who have something to play for. And I did, I spent a fair amount of time last night working out a variety of points possibilities and sent that into Racer. I'm told that's going to run on Thursday, so since it's not up now, I'll just mention a couple of the things looking through here. And we're not going to run through the million different scenarios, but supporting everything you mentioned, Lee, Dixie doesn't have it easy going in, but there's going to have to be a lot of pressure exerted on him to have to do truly, truly impressive things if Rossi really wants a chance to win. So there are a couple things that, again, just throwing a couple factoids here. Since 2010, Team Penske has won 75% of the races at Sonoma Raceway. They've won 6 out of 8. The two that weren't won by Penske, won by Scott Dixon. So that's a good thing to know right there. Dixie, looking at his 14 performances at Sonoma, has finished inside the top five 7 times. He has a 50% finishing rate inside the top five, and that includes 3 wins if you throw in the one from 2007. So before we get into the real, you know, if Rossi finishes here, Dixon must finish their side, those two numbers are pretty staggering. They tell us a couple things, mate. Well, first of all, we know that mathematically there are 4 drivers eligible, that being Dixon, Rossi, and then way back remotely, Will Power and Joseph Newgarden, who are tied for third place. The Penske team has been the one to beat this decade at Sonoma. Who is the guy who wants, frankly, Team Penske to win and then kind of fart home around fifth or whatever? Scott Dixon. A really, if Dixie cannot sit on pole and or lead and win the race, if that for whatever reason just isn't in the cards this weekend, the best thing he can have happen is for Penske's history to shine through yet again and have a great race. Because what does Alexander Rossi need? He needs the biggest helping of points, and those are reserved for the top 2 or 3 finishing positions. Although it's a double points weekend, and there's 100 points total on offer for a win, you start getting past those the podium for the most part, and the real big points are no longer being paid. So the best thing for Dixon, obviously, would be to win, because he wins the championship, period. If he's not in winning form, having the Penskes doing Penske things up front and stealing those points from Rossi, that's the thing he's, oddly, Chip Ganassi would be praying for Roger to have a good day. And then you also look at the fact that, you know, for Newgarden, for Power to win the championship, one of them needs to win the race and effectively have Dixon finished, I feel like, 23rd or so, you know, way in the back. So it's the longest of long shots for the Penske drivers. That's why, you know, other than them spoiling the event for Rossi, which helps Dixon, I'm not really factoring them into a whole lot. The last scenario, which is the one that really jumps out at that, you know, we'll all be following, is if Rossi has a great weekend. Keep in mind he only has 2 starts there, Lee. His first, he finished 5th. Last year, a lot of things went wrong. He finished 21st, unrepresentative of what we know he's capable of. But I think we can assume Rossi is going to be running towards the front, and that's where things get interesting. If Rossi wins, Dixon needs to finish 2nd to earn the championship. And I don't want to get into all the bonus point scenarios. There's 4 total available during the weekend. If Rossi wins and Dixie finishes 2nd, there's nothing Rossi can do, even with bonus points, to take the championship away. Things start to get a little iffy if Dixon's 3rd. Dixie could overcome him if he does have a couple bonus points. Really, what Rossi needs is to win and have Dixon come home 4th. At that point, he would have, just straight points, no bonus, a 7-point lead on Dixon, that even with those 4 extra bonus points, if Dixon had them all, there's nothing he could do to overtake him. That's, I hate to say it, but if I'm Rob Edwards, everything you're thinking about this weekend is Alexander Rossi winning. And if he's winning, he's obviously leading, which is 1 point, and possibly 2 more extra points for leading the most, etc. But where things, believe it or not, Lee, start to get a little bit sideways is if Rossi finishes 2nd. I'm not saying all the pressure comes off Dixon, but he only needs to finish 6th to still win. And he's up by 5 points. Nothing you can do with bonus points to knock him down. If you start getting into, you know, if you start getting much beyond that, if we start talking about Rossi's finishing 3rd and blah, 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 I mean, Dixon, you know, really 8th, 9th, you know, if Rossi's 4th, I mean, we're just talking everything other than a win for Rossi takes 1 extra degree of pressure off of Dixon to have to put in the drive of his life. And that is not the scenario anybody wants to leave Scott Dixon in, as you well know.
There's so many permutations. But I think what we all have to tell ourselves is that We only have to think back 2 weeks ago. Would anybody have predicted what went down in Portland? And the answer is no. Not a chance. Not even close. You know, for there to be a five-car pileup and the only car that gets out of it is Dixon, for Rossi to be at the front of the pack having an awesome race with Joseph Newgarden, both pulling some terrific moves on each other and great racing, only to not come away with a solid result, you know. So I think, you know, we can bury ourselves in all of the permutations, but, you know, I mean, for the Penske duo to win, you know, if Dixon finishes 21st or better, they're done. They can't win. And Scott Dixon, you know, from 303 starts, has only finished 21st 14 times. So the percentages are against them, you know. So there's so many things we can get buried in, but I think it's going to come down to, and I don't want to discount the Penske boys, but it's going to come down to a gripper between, we're going to be watching the Ganassi car and the Andretti car for sure, which is pretty cool, because that's the way it's been for a good chunk of the season, hasn't it?
Absolutely. If you're an Alexander Rossi fan, you are crossing every finger and toe, hoping for a win. Because at least at that point, he has the best control of his destiny in terms of a championship. And after first place, yeah, Dixon starts to have more options. So we'll see what happens there. Let's see. John Sable on Twitter says, do you think IndyCar Sonoma would have benefited from running one of its other layouts? He says, I hate how IndyCar skips the full S's, then cuts out the final turn to drive through the parking lot. Seems to kill a really great passing opportunity and looks really bad on TV. John, it's funny. Local hero and friend of ours, Jerry Hildebrand, tweeted out last Thursday during the test, man, I really wish for IndyCar's swan song at Sonoma they ran the full proper road course. And that's using all the S's, not the little piece that runs straight and has the chicane there, and then also full turn 11. And I completely agree. Is there enough runoff in 11 if someone had a stuck throttle? No, not at all. That would be a scary, scary thing. I can understand why they have not chosen to do this, John, but I can tell you that just from a spirit standpoint and having grown up at that track and only seen these changes happen in the last two decades or whatever, yeah, I would have loved to have seen that happen, to be really honest. Let's see. James Bishop asks a question that I know you can't really answer, Lee, but we've gotten it in a couple different ways, and I think it speaks positively of the work you and the team happen to put out. He said, question, can you tell us if the entire IndyCar on NBC broadcast team is returning for 2019? Even Robin Miller! I love the even Robin Miller part. I mean, hey, he's never going to retire, so we definitely need to make sure the old man still has work there. But again, I know you're not here to make news or announce news on behalf of NBCSN, Lee, but I'm guessing that if the full team were to return as it is, you, at least on a personal level, would be a rather happy boy.
Yeah, look, I mean, at this stage of the year, you know, every year, certainly, and it's not just our network, but most networks don't make too many announcements about on-air talent for the upcoming year or the season. So, yeah, I mean, you're right in one regard that there's not a whole lot that I can say. But, you know, what I can say is that we're a pretty happy team, and we all get on great, and we love working together. So, I, you know, my fingers are crossed. And, you know, of course, we have other, you've got to remember, we have other team players as well that right now are buried, you know, in the NASCAR playoff scene, and that's Marty Snyder and, yep, and Kelly Stavis. So, you know, it's not just the team that you see week out. We've got quite an extended team. So, hey, we're a happy motorsport on NBC family. So, yeah, fingers crossed that we can all be together next year for sure. We'd love it because we get on great off air and on air.
PNC is proud to sponsor Scott Dixon, driver of the number 9 car for Chip Ganassi Racing. Scott knows that the road to victory lane starts today. Copyright 2018, the PNC Financial Services Group Incorporated. All rights reserved. PNC Bank, National Association, member FDIC.
All right, Lee, let's pick up a few more from Twitter, then we'll jump back to Facebook. Joshua Reniker says, if you could take a driving trait from one past driver and put it in a current IndyCar driver, who and what trait, who gets it, and why? Great question, Josh. Do you want me to take that, Mr. Diffie, or you want that one?
Can I put my 2 cents worth in?
Of course. No, actually, I called you just so you could listen to me talk.
And I guess this is specific to ovals, but I just used to get so excited. I as a viewer, you know, even back in the day, and as a fan, and then I got to do it as a commentator. I just used to love Michael Andretti's outside moves on an oval, particularly early in the race. You know, Michael was never afraid to go up high and round them up, and I always thought that was exhilarating.
A man who knew no fear. No, that's great. Who would you take that outside oval bravery and instill that in? I would say his son has. Definitely has that oval bravery.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Is there another driver today who you would try and give that to, and why?
It's a good question. Well, I think Graham Rahal has it as well.
I think Marco has it.
I think Graham Rahal has it. I think Alexander Rossi has it. Who would I put it in? Maybe another Andretti driver. Maybe Zach Veach. But I think in a way, I think he kind of has it as well.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you heard our broadcast. In Portland, and Ryan Hunter-Reay was so complimentary of Zach Veach, and just said, when we look at the traces, when we look at the telemetry, right where you need to really bring out your bravery, this little guy's got it in spades. So that's pretty interesting. So yeah, I mean, I know it's high risk, I know it's super risky, but I love watching those high wide moves, and it reminds me so much of Michael back in the day. So yeah, maybe let's give it to one of his drivers. Give it to Zach.
I like that. I like that idea a lot. Let's see. Who should we go to next? All right. Anthony Johnson says, with Formula One running into a driver number crunch, how well positioned is IndyCar to grab extremely talented drivers from Europe for the series? Huh. That's a good one, Anthony. And I would say the most heartening thing I've seen, and I know you've seen this as well of late, Lee, is that while there's certainly the potential of some talent falling off the vine in F1 that could be acquired possibly if those drivers had interest for IndyCar, I've been really happy to see and hear more team owners talking about, hey, what about that Colin Brown guy? What about this guy over here? Looking around North America, not necessarily Americans, but looking on the home front for some potential talent. I know last weekend I spoke with Action Express Daytona prototype driver Felipe Nasr, who visited the Watkins Glen IndyCar race last year as a guest of Elio Castroneves, former Sauber F1 driver. And I am incredibly thankful that the Action Express team has hired him and put him to work in IMSA. I will also say that, with no disrespect to IMSA, every day he is not competing in an IndyCar is a waste of some pretty amazing talent. So he's here, he's interested, and I know Bobby Rahal, for example, has reached out to him. Could something happen there? I don't know. But between him, Pippo Durrani, we just saw, signed with Action Express. He's someone else who I think IndyCar teams would be smart to look at. Already here, working, knows a lot of the tracks. Colin Brown, we've already mentioned. He came close, from what I understand, from being in the number 6 Schmidt car at Sonoma, at least. And would have really loved to have seen that for him. I'm hoping he does at least get a test. But I don't know, Anthony. In years past, I might have looked to Formula One a little bit harder and said, hey, how can we get a hold of this kid or that guy? Boy, they'd really do the business here. Maybe loving a little bit more of those who have chosen to come to America or are already here, someone born and raised in Texas like Colin Brown, who've said, hey, don't forget me. I'd love to do this. I'm not coming from far away. I can, you know, hop on a plane from Miami or wherever and be at that test, be in that car. So that's at least my perspective, Lee. What about you? You still think there's some F1 talent we, you know, the Stoffel Van Dorns of the world we should try and latch on to? Or do you think we've got a good thing going already over here?
I think there's a nice blend of both. I agree with you wholeheartedly about, you know, the Colin Browns of the world and Felipe Nasr. I thought Felipe was perhaps in Formula One not long enough. Pretty sure that that relationship with Ericsson was quite toxic in the way that they drove each other, etc. So I thought he, given his pedigree in F3 and for when he first came to the Rolex 24, I was quite a fan of his in F1, so I wanted him to get a better go. But it just, maybe it might be a comedic standpoint or not, or maybe it's just me, being a fan of his. I was hoping that maybe we might get to see Kimi Raikkonen come to IndyCar, given the whole Alonso storyline and thread. And then, obviously, we've learned this week that that Kimi's going to race in F1 with Sauber for the next couple of years, and Charles Leclerc goes over to Ferrari. So I think that'll probably see Kimi out for his open wheel racing days. So that avenue's come to a stop. But I don't think we need to be. Van Dorn could come over. I mean, he's terrific, and perhaps didn't do what he could have done in Formula One. I know it wasn't an ideal circumstance with power units, et cetera, at McLaren, but I think he's got some unfinished business, and why not? This amazing thread and pipeline of talented young Americans. So the Alexander Rossis, and I don't want to exclude Ryan Hunter-Reay, but he's won the 500, won the championship, been around. He is the most celebrated and successful active American driver. Now you have Alexander Rossi, Joseph Newgarden, who's the reigning champion until this weekend. Hey, who knows, maybe he might win back-to-back. The Zach Beaches, the Spencer Pigots, the list goes on. Now Colton Herta, about to become the first IndyCar driver born in the 2000s. While we've got that thread and that pipeline going, why not sprinkle it with some internationals for sure? Because that's always been the attraction of IndyCar for decades.
All right, Lee, we're getting down to about the last 15 minutes for you. I'll throw in one little item here. This is not any kind of breaking news. This is nothing based on, I got real inside knowledge. I'm just sharing something that I don't know if it's been put in print yet, but I'll share it here. A lot of the conversations I've had of late with people in the IndyCar paddock, this is team managers, owners, and drivers, on the topic of McLaren and Alonso and 2019, it's really interesting to hear one question and concern that I've been getting on a regular basis in the last couple of weeks, and that is this. It's not how many races will Fernando do. It's not will Fernando choose IndyCar. It's will Zach Brown still be CEO of McLaren Racing at the end of the Formula One season here? And if he's not, does that mean McLaren and the concept of branching out into IndyCar leaves with Zach? And again, I'm not going to put names on this, but the number of people and the caliber of people who have posed that exact question, and that question comes from a place of concern. It's something that I hadn't really taken into account heavily before, but I think we could say, Lee, based on a lot of things we know, and a lot of things we think we know, that this is Zach's baby. Right, I haven't heard about longtime McLaren stakeholder Mansoor Ogier being the one waking up saying IndyCar, it's the only thing I want. We must do it. I've only ever known this to be a project really led by the passion and desire of Zach, all which is awesome. But I would say I think where the concerns have come in on. Is he still going to be there? Is McLaren going to retain his services beyond the end of this F1 season? I don't know his contract. Again, don't know a lot of things. Just know that I've had a heck of a lot of people say, I'm concerned he might not be there. And if he's not there, then I seriously can't find a way where this McLaren / Andretti thing moves forward in any capacity for Fernando Alonso to be a part of. That wouldn't, in theory, Lee, preclude Fernando from ringing up Michael Andretti and saying, hey, whether it's with McLaren or not, can I be in one of your cars for the Indy 500 or wherever else? But it's definitely, it seems to be a quiet, behind-the-scenes concern that if Zach is no longer there, this McLaren dream might go away.
And look, that's a fair assumption for people to make. I think you mentioned the most important thing. You don't know, and I don't know. We're not in the inner sanctum. We don't know, but on the general level, broad strokes, that's a very fair assumption, because you could use a college football coach, you could use an English Premier League coach or manager. If they're not performing, questions start to get asked, and whether people are in the know or not, you're in the business to bring the business, bring the performance, bring the sponsors.
You so want to say bring the action right now, don't you?
I want to say bring the action, no. But, you know, look, I think that's a very fair assumption, and I guess we're going to just have to wait and see. I sure hope Fernando is here. I really do.
I love that guy.
I think he discovered a lot about racing in America, and he discovered a lot about himself throughout that month of May experience. I think he discovered plenty by just turning up at, and I'm not talking about the test recently, I'm talking about last year when he first turned up, when he travelled from Sochi, from the Russian Grand Prix to Barber Motorsports Park in Alabama, and just saw how, you know, because it's a totally different environment to when he would come to Circuit of the Americas every year. And so I think that was an all-encompassing, and it sounds quite silly to say that a two-time world champion and one of the best drivers ever learned something, but he did. He really did. And I can tell you that, you know, my very good friend Mark Webber is incredibly close to Fernando, and he loved it. He absolutely loved his time here. And so just for that and that alone, you know, who knows what's going to happen with the McLaren hierarchy and executive people. But, you know, if he's not here at least for the 500 next year, I think that'd be a bit of a bummer.
He even phoned in during the Texas race, Lee. I mean, how cool is that? Hey, we got a guest caller. Fernando Alonso is ringing in during the race. I mean, it is just awesome. I think what he found was the simplicity that had been missing for far too long in motor racing for him. Something that he knows he can get in a go-kart by himself, but in terms of a real serious on a professional level, wow, this is just simple. I get in the car and I drive it, and I talk with people, and we come up with ideas, and it's just stripped of all the things that maybe take away the joy, or were taking away the joy. So I think that's what we've seen in him when he has touched down an IndyCar on a few different points. All right, let's get into the last couple of questions, my friend. Our pal Jerry Suddeth says, Lee, entering the finale, if you could script the Sonoma race, how would it go?
I think it would go where we have been in previous years, where I know it drives some people crazy, but we are constantly doing those points as of now, and there is a position or two in it coming down to those closing laps to determine who is going to win the championship. And again, you know, the Penske guys know that it's a real long shot for them. They understand that. I mean, even Will Power said that in his post-race interview after Portland, but to me, that's what's gripping. You know, that's what is the best thing about sport. You know, the other day, watching the New York Giants come back, you know, with minutes to go, and they brought the deficit down to five, and they had a couple of minutes left, and were they able to, you know, to do it? You know, and in the end, they weren't. But just that gripping element, that real element, the true, legitimate element of sport, where things can change in a moment, but time's running out, and laps are running out, that's what gets me excited. Townsend, Paul, all of our team. It gets any broadcaster excited when, you know, Justify win the Triple Crown? Yes, it did. You know, just all of those beautiful natural elements of sport that can change. So that's what I hope. That's what I hope the script's going to be, is that we don't know until those closing laps, which takes us back just a couple of years ago. And I, if I could knock on wood, cross my fingers, that's what I hope for you guys, you know, the listeners of Marshall's podcast and regular viewers of the races, and for everybody involved in for the series, because, you know, let's not forget, at the end of the day, the series has done a heck of a job to put the series in this position yet again, where it's going to be determined in the final race. People have loved the cars. Not every race has been great this year, okay? We have to admit that. There's a couple of oval races that weren't terrific. But Jay Fry and the competition department are going to work on that and keep refining. But overall, it's been a heck of a season. And so I think it the series itself and us as the fans and the viewers and the broadcasters and stakeholders and partners and everybody involved, you know, deserves a little bit of a thriller of a finish.
Got a great closing question from Zachary Campbell I'm going to save for the end here. I'm going to blast through a couple of here, Lee, just to try and get through as many as we can. Garen Batten says, gents, a return to Gold Coast for IndyCar, discuss. Very simple discussion. Yes, now, and please. And I'll be trying to find out more from Mark Miles when I bring him back, because he mentioned he...
You just want me to take you back to that bar on Tedder Avenue in Main Beach where you met Mick Doohan for the first time.
I know Mick has been waiting for me there. I told him I'd be back. Let's see, Ryan Terpstra. I'm going to get into this more in depth during the off-season, Ryan, but I'll definitely give you a quick shot here. It says, who has had the most disappointing season? For me, it's Graham Rahal. Consistent qualifying issues and mostly lackluster finishes. I am in agreement with you, Ryan. I am not, in this instance, actually pointing much in the way of fingers at Graham, though. I think they will look back at 2018 and say the decision to break up the well-oiled engineering machine that was Eddie Jones as race engineer for Graham, move Eddie over to Takuma Sato, incoming Takuma Sato, move Tom German up to race engineer role. He's a past former Indy 500 winning race engineer, but just saying in the RLL structure, it was a new post for him. Moving him over to be Graham's race engineer, that I would say they're going to look back at and say, ooh, we tried, didn't work. My suggestion would be to go back to the 2017 lineup, which was everybody with Eddie leading Graham's car, and move Tom over to Taku's car there. I would say that watching Graham trackside at many, many tracks this year, Ryan, I have rarely seen him drive harder trying to extract speed from a car that was just not capable of delivering it to the level he was accustomed to. So this is not a case of him not trying hard enough or his head being out of the game. We've said that in the past years ago, and there was something to it. He didn't like hearing it, but I can't say too much about him this year. I think it was just I wouldn't have made that call. If you got something working, don't mess with it. But I'd be surprised if they didn't go back. Here's a nice note, Lee, from Donald Gowron. He says, no questions. Just many thanks to Marshall, Rob, and Lee, and the many other featured guests that were part of and contributed to such outstanding and informative podcasts throughout the season. Looking forward to what 2019 has to offer from multiple standpoints. It's very kind of you, Donald. Let's see, a couple more here, and then we're going to get to our final one. All right, Nathan Barnes says, could you please explain the strategy behind the typical use of black primary tires for a, quote, banker lap during qualifying before putting on reds? I would think running both runs on a set of reds would be a more advantageous solution instead of an alternate strategy to be used to bet on a red flag. Is this due to a limit on the number of available sets of reds or competitive sessions? A little bit of both, Nathan. The more laps you put on your Firestone reds, knowing that they are not meant for as long a life as the blacks, the more laps you're putting on them in qualifying, you're essentially robbing from yourself in the race, competitive laps in the race. So, and in some cases, not always, we've seen where the blacks are not that far behind the reds in outright pace. The gap isn't huge. So the practice of going out and putting in that banker lap on blacks, knowing that if there was a red flag, at least there'd be something of quality to rely on to get through into the next qualifying stage. That's the reason why. Everyone could go red, 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 red all the time. We've seen that on rare occasion. It's usually from teams that are not really in a position to win on Sunday. But for the most part, keeping the mileage down on the reds and qualifying is the intent, because it's going to help in the race where it matters most. All right. Daniel Macbeth, I'll answer this one quickly, then we'll get to Zachary's closer. It says, after seeing the addition of Coda, I read that Texas Motor Speedway let go of their Indy monopoly after a reduced series fee was granted to TMS. Can you explain the economics of bringing IndyCar to a track? I don't know about the reduced series fee related to monopoly and such with TMS. I know that a lower sanctioning fee is something being requested by the SMI-owned tracks. That was Texas and both Sonoma, which they're not going forward. But this, to me, was not a case of Texas having control over whether IndyCar was going to COTA or not. This was IndyCar saying, we're going to COTA, period. And if you don't like it, then we're not doing business, but we'd rather keep you. And those things end up working out. But I wouldn't tie going to COTA and the allowance, there being any, quote, allowance for IndyCar to go to COTA based on Texas granting something or IndyCar being willing to give up something, a lower sanction fee to Texas in order to get that. I'd say every single item there is independent. All right, let's get to our last question of the final week in IndyCar during this season, Lee, presented by Cooper Tires and PNC Bank. Zachary Campbell says, how do you think people will remember this season, in particular when it comes to the history of American open-wheel racing? Anything from a preface to 2019 and Alonso Mania to the return to the spirit of what IndyCar racing is, question mark? Thanks again for doing all you guys do, and I can't wait for this weekend in 2019. Where do you think 2018, Lee, sits among some of the better or more memorable seasons of IndyCar racing? And are there any aspects that jump out as truly worthy of remembering and trumpeting?
Oh, 100%. I think with Will Power surpassing AJ Foyt for, you know, second most all-time pole positions, that's one thing. The other thing, whether he wins it or not, the championship, that is, whether Scott Dixon becomes a five-time champion or not, I think it should be remembered for where Scott's put himself on the all-time wins list. And as, you know, up there, you know, when he was a kid starting out in New Zealand, could he have ever imagined to be in that rarefied air surrounded by, you know, Mario Andretti and AJ Foyt and the Unser family name? I probably don't think so. You know, I know Scott and his family quite well. They're very humble, working class people, just, you know, and I think that's an amazing accomplishment. If Rossi wins the championship, it's a terrific American story for a California kid who wanted to go to F1, got there with the wrong team, and came back and wins the Indy 500 and then wins the championship in 2018. I think there are many levels why we should remember this championship, this season, for many reasons. Power, you know, Will Power winning the Indianapolis 500, the cars getting back, and I mean this in all due respect to previous iterations and people involved, the cars getting back to look like an Indy car should look. You know, we're in the ballpark of 750 horsepower now with the new engine configuration coming in the coming years, getting back to 950 horsepower. To me, I think this is a season that should be remembered for IndyCar getting back to where IndyCar belongs.
Amen.
People talking about IndyCar on a global level again as exciting and legitimate and worthwhile watching and great racing and great passing and good-looking cars and terrific tracks, and that's why I think this season should be remembered, what it should be remembered for.
And I'll just throw in quickly from my end, whether he does or does not win the championship, I will remember 2018 as the year of Alexander Rossi, and not just for his performances this year, Lee, but this as being the year where he told us, I'm going to be the next Scott Dixon for the next 10 or 15 years. This kid has shown us, he's 26, he'll be 27 at the end of the month. You know, I don't know how many years Dixie is going to hang around. I hope it's a long time. I would love nothing more than to see Dix get his fifth championship. Five. I mean, that number is just tantalizing. Amazing. But and if Dixon wins again, it's not as if it isn't his year. It's him being the best of his generation yet again, all at age 38. But to me, the bottom line, when I look back to 2018, it's going to be how Alexander Rossi, as Michael Andretti once did, as Allanser Jr. once did, as so many others once did, said, "Hey, I'm about to be the man." And that is pretty darn awesome. Lee Diffie, you know I love you. You know I appreciate you taking time, even when you didn't have any. Like today, I will look forward to seeing you. Not so much PT, a little bit Towny Bell. I kind of like Kevin Lee, though. Miller, I've learned to put up with that guy. But all kidding aside, we also have the announcement that NBC/NBCSN is going to be our full-time home starting next year. So that's another great gift we've gotten this season. But thank you for you being you, and many of us are looking forward to hearing how you and the team send us home on Sunday at Sonoma.
Can't wait. Thanks, and just thanks to all your listeners on the podcast. I know that it's super popular, and you've had so many downloads, and it's a pleasure. I appreciate the listener who thanked us and Robin and everybody who contributes to your podcast, but it's fun for us folks too, you know, just to speak in a relaxed format. And you know, we're quite often Marshall's restricted by words that he has to write. I'm restricted by the rules of television. We're all, you know, we only have so much time, whereas this is a more relaxed format and allows us to speak in a more relaxed way, in a more open way. So it's just as fun for us. So thanks, and hope you all enjoy this weekend at Sonoma.
Thanks to Cooper Tires and PNC Bank. And guess what? We'll speak to you next week, and we get to talk about our new champion.